It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. The worship associate is Marcia Sharp, and I would invite her to the pulpit now to read you her affirmation of faith.
I devoutly believe in religious tolerance until I have to be tolerant. Religious beliefs cloaked in political agendas and laws drive me nuts. Religious extremists of any stripe make me scared for our world. When a Jehovah's Witness knocks on my door early on a Saturday morning, I bristle and am abrupt, which reinforces their belief that their brand of religion is truly needed. How am I supposed to be tolerant of someone who wants to cram their beliefs down my throat, rule my world with their brand of what is right, and make everyone the same? I have to admit, there is some personal history that contributes to my brand of intolerance. I grew up in a small South Texas town that was supported mostly by farming, oil and gas, and chemical plants in the area, conservative, apple pie, and the American dream in the 1950s. Mother was a teacher, and my dad worked for an oil company. His days off were Sundays and Mondays, Sunday being the only day we had together as a family. We spent those Sundays together doing something outdoors, going somewhere, working around the house. The list of activities did not include going to church. In fact, we were the only family in the area that did not go to church. Nothing was ever said directly about my lack of church affiliation or attendance until I reached third grade. My teacher, Mrs. Rogers, was the wife of a Baptist minister, and in her opinion, everyone had to be saved from eternal damnation, especially that little sharp girl. Each school day, a different student would say a prayer before we went to lunch. I managed to avoid the prayer time until I was asked directly to say a prayer. How in the world do you say a prayer? I remember saying something about the trees, school, and friends, nothing about the impending lunch or God. What kind of prayer was that? Another student was invited to say a proper prayer. Each Monday, every student in that third grade class was required to speak before the class and tell about their activities during the weekend. Of course, church was never on my roster activities, so everyone knew what heretics the Sharp family was breeding. My mother was furious, not only for what I was going through, but the fact that little kids were being bullied by this woman about religion. Being a small town, there was only one third grade teacher, and I had two younger brothers coming up behind me. Mother bided her time and let her have it after all of us were out of her class. By this time, I was in high school. That was when the witch hunt began. Rumors began floating around the two communities that made up the school district. Mrs. Sharp and her family do not attend church. Is this the kind of person you want teaching your children? Never mind that Mrs. Sharp's children were on the honor roll, weren't pregnant or fathering children, nor were they in jail. Mother's solution was to go to church. I went with her, and the UU Fellowship in Victoria, Texas, was my first official church attendance. Mother and I attended while I was in high school. It was the first time I felt comfortable in a church. I remember my astonishment when we walked into the church one morning and there stood my English teacher. He'd been a member for years. The school board finally got brave enough to question Mother about her non-church attendance, and she countered. Of course, not one of them knew what a UU church was, much less what it stood for. The fact that she attended a church seemed to suffice, although they weren't too certain it was a proper church. Nothing about our family's fundamental beliefs or behaviors had changed, but the act of going to church seemed to be enough. I was a UU slacker through college and early adult life. When Mother died, Matthew McNaught, minister of this church at that time, performed her services beautifully. That's when I joined this church, and it's been my home ever since. So, back to my original dilemma. How can I be tolerant of those who try to foist their beliefs on me? I'm tolerant of my devoutly Baptist neighbor with whom I walk on weekends. I'm tolerant of all of your varied beliefs. But then none of you or my neighbor have tried to make me believe what you want me to believe. I'm still a work in progress. I haven't figured out how to be tolerant of others' intolerance. I keep telling myself they try so hard to mold everyone in the world in their ideal image because they're afraid of anything that is different from them. I also have a fear. My intolerance for others' religious intolerance makes me like them.
In the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Let us join together in an attitude of prayer. In many ways, we know so little, yet we guide our lives and our actions toward others based on the little that we know. And sometimes we do harm because we hadn't understood, because we hadn't cared, because we didn't know the right little things. Let us take an honest inventory of the little things we know and test them with both head and heart. When we judge and condemn others, have we understood that they, no less than we, are children of God? If we are alienated by those who love differently than we do, have we remembered that it is a gift to the world when we can love at all? When we see that another's values would not feed our souls, can we also see that means our values might not feed theirs? If the God of understanding were watching the way we treat those with whom we disagree, would that God say that we have really understood them? If the goddess of love were watching, would she say that we had added to the amount of love in the world or subtracted from it? And if all the people we most admire, those with the clearest understandings or the biggest hearts, if they were watching us, would we feel ashamed or proud? We know so little, yet must guide our lives by the little we know. We seek ways of being and living that can make us better people, partners, parents, and citizens. Let us pray that our actions may make us agents of a deeper understanding and a broader love. For the world needs those gifts far more than it needs our little certainties. When we can't respect others enough, when we can't love them enough to bless their best intentions, let us pray for the character to treat them as we might, if only we could, understand them better or love them more. We offer this prayer with honest minds, open hearts, and a grateful reverence for this amazing gift of life. Amen. This begins and ends with stories. One day the devil and one of his little helpers were sitting on a cloud looking down at humans below. And they saw a man walking down a road who stopped, picked something up, put it in his pocket and walked on. What did he find? Asked the devil's helper. A piece of the truth, chuckled the devil. Oh, my God, stop him. Oh, no, said the devil. Never. It's only a tiny piece of the truth. He'll take it home, turn it into an orthodoxy, and then he'll be doing my work. There are ways that that story sums up the history of almost all religions, if not an essential part of human nature. It's like the ancient Hindu story of the blind people and the elephant, though with a vengeance in this one. Both these stories are immediately recognizable because they're both about a human condition that hasn't changed much over the centuries. I think one of the original sins of our species is that we will never have more than a few pieces of the truth, but we always want to pretend that we have the whole thing and that everyone else needs to find what we have found. I spent several years studying theology back in graduate school. At its best, theology is the study of those deep and abiding kinds of truths that can set us free. But mostly, it's the study of how each religious thinker managed to find one tiny piece of truth, then turn it into an idol that often became the enemy of honest religion and too often the enemy of both truth and humanity. So the question of religious toleration is a complicated one because there's a lot that should not be tolerated. And part of the art is learning which is which. When I went on the internet and Googled religious toleration, there are a tremendous number of sites that will come up if you do that. I was drawn to two fairly dramatic sites. The first was the Roman Catholic Encyclopedia. Catholics think very logically and well on the themes they've chosen to think on. They pointed out that we only tolerate things that we think are wrong or evil, but don't want to speak up against. No one will say we must show toleration towards courage or love, because those are things we encourage. Not surprisingly, the Catholic Church is against freedom of belief, which asserts the right of each person to believe what he pleases. And they quote Pope Leo XIII, writing on this from 1885, when he wrote this, "The gravest obligations requires the acceptance and practice not of the religion which one may choose, but of that which God prescribes, and which is known by certain and indubitable marks to be the only true one." I don't think he means Hinduism or Buddhism. In the domain of science and of faith alike, the article continues, truth is the standard, the aim, and the guide of all investigation, but love of truth and truthfulness forbid every honorable investigator to tolerate error or falsehood. In other words, for the Catholic Encyclopedia, freedom of belief is only freedom to choose the truth, and the only religious truth is, coincidentally, owned by the Catholic Church. Well, there's that guy picking up the tiny piece of truth and the devil watching with delight. I also came on a much more dramatic website, one called BibleBelievers.org. The headline attracted my attention. In very big, dark letters, it said, "The cult of liberty is the recipe of moral breakdown." You've got to love people who talk like that. It looked interesting. Beneath the headline, they said the only thing conservatives can hope for now is a moral reawakening of the United States. They were encouraged by the fact that the conservatives in power are going to dismantle the welfare state. Bravo, they wrote. Then they asked, but what about dismantling abortion, gay rights, birth control pills and devices, sex education, dirty movies and TV, women's liberation, secular humanism in the schools? These are the true plagues of American society, they wrote, not high taxes or welfare, and these diseases are the effect of the general breakdown of the morals of the people. And the problem is that these infections cannot be eradicated legally and logically except by some principle, a principle which restricts human freedom only to those objects which are good. Both these websites are variations on the story of people grabbing tiny pieces of truth, or the myth of the blind people and the elephant. And they show why the United States of America, luckily for us, has had freedom of belief for nearly all of its history. Each of these religious groups has picked up a tiny piece of truth, smothered it in a ton of arrogance, and each has confused truth with what they happen to believe. The Catholics would be embarrassed by some of the hateful bigotries of BibleBelievers.org, though they share many of them. And when BibleBelievers.org speaks of goodness or truth, they do not mean the kind the Catholic Church has. Back when we had British colonies, before the Revolutionary War, that gave us the right to make our own laws, almost all the colonies were examples of what can happen when those tiny pieces of truth are given the power of law. For example, when the colony of Maryland published something famously called an Act Concerning Religion in 1649. In that act, they said that anyone who denied that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, or denied the Trinity, or said anything bad about them, was to be put to death, and their properties would all be seized by the colony. That's what it means to say that when people find a tiny piece of truth and turn it into an orthodoxy, they are doing the devil's work. I think I would say that orthodoxies are the devil's work, because they're always that guy picking up a little bit of truth and wrapping it in a ton of arrogance. Now, the problem with this is that I'm still with the BibleBelievers.org and the Catholic Church when they say that we should encourage truth but not tolerate untruths masking as truth. And I'm even with them when they say that liberals have far too often been willing to bless anything, including things that shouldn't be blessed. Sometimes liberals are accused of having minds so open that our brains have fallen out. That's too open. But what's this truth business, especially something like the kind of truth that could set you free? The short answer is that that's what all the best religious thinkers in all the world's religions have always been trying to say. The best religious and philosophical thinkers have tried to help us understand what this greater truth is like, but not many read them. Aristotle, as the Catholic Encyclopedia had noted in their long article, Aristotle taught that wisdom consists in choosing the middle road between extremes, because extremes can be either too permissive or too narrow and brutal. In the Quran of the religion of Islam, these are things we need to hear because we don't understand Islam very well, and we need to know the depth that the religion has if it's taken seriously. In the Quran, there were no obligatory doctrines about God. Indeed, the Quran is highly suspicious of theological speculation, dismissing it as self-indulgent guesswork about things that nobody can possibly know or prove. The Quran teaches that God had sent messengers to every people on the face of the earth. Islamic tradition says there had been 124,000 such prophets. That's a symbolic number suggesting infinity. So the Koran repeatedly points out that it is not bringing a message that's essentially new, and that Muslims must emphasize their kinship with the older religions. Don't we wish those were the voices of Islam that were dominating? Don't they wish similar voices were dominating Christianity and Judaism? Behind Christianity was the figure of the man Jesus, who would have hated Christianity. Jesus said, "Don't judge." He said, "Treat others the way you'd want to be treated." He even said to let the wheat and the weeds grow together, which sounds far more permissive than even the cult of liberty. The Buddha taught that when we have to choose between doing the right thing and doing the compassionate thing, we should choose the compassionate thing. Why? Because when we choose the right thing, we're probably choosing the thing dictated to us by that little tiny piece of truth we picked up, and it's probably not big enough to include life. Taoism has an even more subtle kind of teaching. It's really very subtle. They say everything's always in movement, either coming to be or passing away. The weak is growing strong, the strong is growing weak. Light moves into dark, dark moves into light, so on and so forth. And that means that certainty is actually the weakest place you can be in, because from there, everything's down. And Jews have such a way of taking a story that seems rigid and harsh, and then soaking it in so much human warmth and wit that it just melts into understanding and compassion. One of my favorite stories, it has many, many versions, was about a small village which prided itself on enforcing the strictest kind of obedience to the law, like that 1649 Act of Religion by the Maryland Colony. The village was losing so many people it was on the verge of dying. They couldn't understand how they could be dying when they were so right. So one of their elders traveled to a large town nearby to see a rabbi who was known far and wide for his wisdom. He told the rabbi their strange plight. They were dead right, but they were nearly dead as a village. The rabbi nodded, and he said, "Your sin is the sin of ignorance. You see, the Messiah is among you, and you are ignorant of this fact. Now go home." The man returned home, hardly willing to believe such a preposterous thing. After all, he knew everyone in the village. There were fewer and fewer of them every day. And there wasn't anybody who could possibly be pure enough to be the Messiah. Maybe him, but he wasn't going to claim that. When he told the other villagers, they didn't believe it either. Still, the old rabbi was famous for his wisdom, and nobody wanted to say he was a fool, so they began wondering if he could be right. What if old Goldberg over there could possibly be the Messiah, or Mrs. Robbins? Impossible. Still, just in case, they began treating others as though they might be the Messiah. Now you can see the end of the story coming. The village flourished because they had let go of their tiny little truthlets and found the more difficult and more full kind of truth, and it had set them free, first of their certainty and their arrogance, and then of their smallness. The truth worth serving, the truth that can set us free, has to first set us free from our narrowest certainties. Those certainties that would shrink the world to the size of our biases and habits. That's the irony of places like BibleBelievers.org and that kind of essay in the Catholic Encyclopedia. While willing to fight or even kill for the truth, they don't realize that they have become among its greatest enemies, and that they make the devil laugh with glee at his new disciples. I don't think any church or any religion can be trusted to know the truth when they see it, because that story of the man who picked up the little piece of truth and made an orthodoxy out of it, that seems to be the story of human nature. That's why the insights of the founding thinkers of great religions are almost always the enemies of the religions founded on them. The religion about Jesus has almost nothing in common with the religion of Jesus. Of all the people who might hate Islamic fundamentalism, none would hate it more than Muhammad. The Buddha would be at least saddened to see the rank superstition that 98% of Buddhists mistake for Buddhism, and on down the line. Let me put this in Texas terms. You don't let Budweiser choose the drinks, or all you'll have is beer. I knew that would connect. This was just too high and abstract. Okay. You don't let Christians define the truth, or no one else is safe. Or Muslims or Buddhists. And when the only tool you own is a hammer, it's amazing how much everything starts to look like a nail. Yet behind it all, there's still this thing called truth that's still worth pursuing and can still set us free. But today it seems that it has to set us free first from the religions that identify truth with their beliefs, or from nationalisms that identify it with their borders, or from every other example of people doing the devil's work by beating others to death with their tiny little pieces of truth. Their name is Legion. One part of the truth is that none of us will ever have it all. We are all that person who picked up the little piece of truth and put it in our pocket. And you could say that both the gods and the devils are watching to see what we'll do with it, whether we'll use it to serve the demons of our lower nature or the angels of our better nature. So another way of looking at the kinds of truth we should encourage, which kinds we should tolerate, and which kinds we should actively oppose, is by asking whether the ideals we're following make us a blessing or a curse, whether our presence here has increased or decreased the amount of understanding and compassion in the world. Now, there's a wonderful story about this, which comes from the writings of Ralph Waldo Emerson. The Unitarians want to claim him, though he didn't think so much of them, and once called them corpse cold. But I don't much care what club he belonged to. I only care whether the tiny bit of truth he picked up seems worthy of the best that we can be. This is like the story of the man going down the road, but this time he picked up something that opened his heart and it made all the difference. Here's the story Emerson wrote. The friar Bernard lamented in his cell on Mount Chenis the crimes of mankind, and rising one morning before day from his bed of moss and dry leaves, he gnawed his roots and berries, drank of the spring, and set forth to go to Rome to reform the corruption of mankind. On his way, he encountered many travelers who greeted him courteously, and the cabins of the peasants and the castles of the lords supplied his few wants. When he came at last to Rome, his piety and goodwill easily introduced him to many families of the rich. And on the first day, he saw and talked with gentle mothers with their babes at their breasts, who told him how much love they bore their children and how they were perplexed in their daily walk lest they should fail in their duty to them. "What?" he said. "And this on rich embroidered pagan carpets? On marble floors with cunning sculpture and carved wood and rich pictures and piles of books about you? What? Look at our pictures and books," they said, "and we will tell you, good father, how we spent the last evening." These are stories of godly children and holy families and romantic sacrifices made in old or in recent times by great and not mean persons. And last evening, our family was collected, and our husbands and brothers discoursed sadly on what we could save and give in the hard times. Then came in the men, and they said, "What cheer, brother? Does thy convent want gifts?" Then the Friar Bernard went home swiftly with other thoughts than he had brought, saying, "This way of life is wrong. Yet these Romans, whom I prayed God to destroy, are lovers. They are lovers. What can I do?" Here's someone who worshiped something very different from the BibleBelievers.org or those who wrote that essay in the Catholic Encyclopedia. The wise old rabbi would have smiled at the story, though the devil would not have liked it. We become what we worship. If all we will ever have are tiny pieces of the truth, let us choose very carefully what we make of them.